I once heard an expert on churches say that the way a congregation was founded puts an imprint on everything else that follows. Sometimes that imprint is positive, and sometimes it is a curse that a congregation can never overcome. We are very lucky here to have had a founding that was inspiring and positive. And the way the fellowship was founded is a gift that keeps on giving. I think it will keep on giving for decades to come. Who knows? Maybe even for centuries. The group of nine who gathered at that first meeting of this congregation on a snowy November evening back in 1955, they were an extraordinary group of people. Bill and Mary Jane Dunwoody discovered Unitarianism in college and graduate school. Relative newcomers to the Fox Cities, they wanted Unitarianism to continue being part of their lives, but to make that happen, they had to roll up their sleeves and create a fellowship. Step one, call a meeting and put an ad in the Post Crescent. Donna and Len Wise were also new to town. Donna had been raised a Unitarian. Len was raised in the Ethical Culture Society. They came to town already thinking about starting a liberal religious fellowship. And so when Len was hired at Lawrence University, he asked the president if the president thought it would be okay for him to work on starting a fellowship. Go to it, the president responded. Margaret Ferris had discovered Unitarianism on the streetcars in Milwaukee. Her route to the teacher's college took her right by the Unitarian Church in downtown Milwaukee, and she noticed outside that church a sign advertising a month-long sermon series on early American writers, many of whom were Unitarians. Well, she happened to be taking a class in early American lit, and she thought this would be a free and effective way to get some extra information for the class. Bert Browning had been teaching at the Institute of Paper Chemistry here for a couple decades, and he had never really settled into his wife Margaret's Presbyterian church, so the ad for a Unitarian gathering caught his eye. A transplant from Hungary, Nushi Ward was a noted social activist in town. Unitarianism's focus on justice in this world felt like a good fit to her. Christine Wise was an activist in town also. She found Unitarianism when she fell in love with a Unitarian minister from Transylvania who was studying at her place in Berkeley. Well, they got married, and side by side, they worked together in a struggling, small Transylvanian village trying to build a better world. After her husband tragically died of tuberculosis, Christine and her young daughter, Enneka, moved back to the United States, to Florida. She reconnected with Louis Wise, a professor at the Institute of Paper Chemistry, and with Enneka, Christine moved to Appleton to join Louis. So I believe these eight people were at this first gathering. I am not clear on who the ninth person was, and I don't think our surviving founders are clear either. 2 years later, when the fellowship incorporated, 19 people signed the membership book as charter members. So in addition to those already named, these folks signed on as well. Helen Hall, James and Lillian Mackesy, Bernice Menarek, Pearl Felton, Eldora Spiegelberg, Hillary Williams, Melvin Mather, Merle Schwei, and Elmer Hagee. I have a feeling it was Bernice Menarek that was the ninth person, but I'm not sure. Now, the Fox Valley in 1955 was not a particularly friendly place to anything liberal. Though he was censured by the United States Senate a year earlier, Senator Joseph McCarthy was still wildly popular in his hometown. The Dunwoodies didn't imagine that anyone would dare come to a meeting that was advertised as being liberal religious. But happily they were wrong. The folks that I have mentioned were not the types to let an environment hostile to religious liberalism prevent them from starting a fellowship. The founders' reason for establishing the fellowship is stated very clearly in the original membership book that they started in 1957. The purpose of this organization, the membership book says, shall be to join its members into a religious and educational fellowship, to develop human character and personal responsibility, to further individual freedom of belief, and to advance liberal religion through study, service, and spiritual consecration. While the language has maybe shifted over the years a bit, I believe that this purpose is still very much at the heart of our fellowship. When I think back on the founders, I think the primary gift they gave us, the gift that does keep on giving, is their visionary and generous spirit. They had an abiding vision of what the fellowship could become. They knew that the Valley desperately needed, a liberal religious congregation, and they knew that way more than 9 people would find such a place and such a vision compelling. They also knew that to grow, the fellowship would need to adapt and change. Unlike a lot of founders of Unitarian fellowships in the 1950s, they embraced the necessity of change from day one. Starting a congregation from scratch takes an enormous amount of work, an enormous amount of dedication, and this group of people had amazing dedication. They set the tone for a fellowship that continues to be blessed by members who give so generously of themselves in so many different ways. So if you're sitting out there today and your name is not Bill Dunwoody or Donna Weiss or Margaret Paris, then it is accurate to say that you are enjoying the spiritual waters from some wells that you did not dig. Without the inspired work of our founders, this fellowship would not be here. And of course, we wouldn't be here if others over the years didn't pick up the baton from the founders and keep things moving forward. So, for example, after some of our founders burned out in the 1970s, another group of folks, plus a few of our founders who seem to have limitless energy, like Len Wise, helped the fellowship survive a very rough period where our attendance got down to often under 10 at a service. Then some of these folks and some new folks did the hard work of buying and rehabbing our first fellowship building in the 1980s and welcoming in ministerial leadership. In the 1990s, we expanded our staff and built this facility. And in this new century, the fellowship has, for the last dozen years, continued to move forward as it has doubled in size. The spiritual waters that quench our thirst are here because of all those who went before. The wells at this fellowship are deep, and they are manifold, and they are a great blessing.
While some of us here are natives of this area, some of us have been here quite a long time, and some of us have not. But whether you come to this place, whether you come from this place, or whether or not your family lives nearby, or you went to high school nearby, this fellowship is a place for all of us of journey, of motion. It is not a place that is standing still, same as it ever was. The source waters of our fellowship run deep and clear. This much is certain. But let us not forget the verb in that statement. The source waters run. The flow of history feeds our livelihood much in the same way that an underground aquifer feeds a well. While the well itself may not move, the water below it, in fact, never stops moving. In fact, it is its movement that makes the water so delicious, so clear. Like a well, this place, this community, relies on motion, on action, to give us what we need to survive. As many of you know, my wife, Jen, and I moved here from St. Paul in August by way of New Jersey. We were excited by the opportunity to come to a new place, and I was personally excited by the opportunity to work with a large and growing congregation of capable Unitarian Universalists, and especially to work with Roger, for whom I have great respect. But not all of me was excited about this move, I'll admit. Moves are never easy, especially when they bring us to new places, places that bring exciting new opportunities, but also some very real challenges. Jen and I knew nothing of northeastern Wisconsin, except that winters are cold and the politics and religion are historically conservative. We left behind our support network and all of our comfortable routines, said goodbye to our friends, and we prepared to move to a place where we knew no one again. You see, over the years of our separate lives, Jen and I have been wayfaring pilgrims in several ways, several times over. Perhaps at no time has this been as true than over the past 3 years, when we've moved from New York City to New Jersey to St. Paul, Minnesota to Appleton. Also in that time, we became parents, which I think, as any of the parents in the room will corroborate, is a process of seemingly perpetual pilgrimage into the unknown. All of this is to say that when we came here, when I came here, I was anything but settled. And I'll speak quite honestly, Appleton is not an easy place for newcomers to break into. I mentioned this at a service last night, and a woman came up to me and told about going to see her, the HR person in her company, who told her that there was an adjustment period of about 2 years before friends and social contacts would begin to ask her to do things with them or something like that. And 2 years can feel like an awfully long time. But shortly after arriving here at the fellowship, I received meals provided by members and cards inscribed with messages of welcome. And I just want to quickly plug that these cards and meals are available to everyone going through transition, provided that we know about it. And so if you would like to be lifted up, please do be in touch. And of course, I felt a warm sense of welcome arriving in the building. I've heard this sentiment from many people who have joined in the past year, a feeling of welcome right when they walked in. I also distinctly recall singing in a service here, these words to Blue Boat Home. I've been sailing all of my life now. Never harbor or port have I known. I remember thinking to myself, yep, that's me. That's where I am right now. Maybe you've had a similar experience where a set of words, either in a hymn or a sermon, maybe a reading, have kind of spoken with you, kind of stuck with you, sometimes stubbornly for a little while. In any case, here I was in this new place with this new bunch of people singing about being adrift. And in that moment, something clicked for me. We are all adrift. We are all pilgrims. Whether we've lived here for 20 minutes or 20 years, we all know what it means to be on a journey. Ours is a lifelong journey, a path of discovery, of the world within, among, and beyond us. Our fellowship is a place of welcome, where travelers who are excited or weary, often both, may find comfort in the compassion and companionship of one another. I gave a sermon shortly after arriving here about my vision of Unitarian Universalism as a campfire, a way of coming together in community, even when our paths are many and varied. Well, I'm here to say today that, like you, I have been warmed by the fire of this community, a fire built by others so that I would have a place of warmth when I arrived. I felt my thirst quenched by deep wells that were dug for me well before I appeared here. And I stand on a foundation and within a tradition that gives meaning to my life and voice to my values. I'm grateful for these gifts every day. The practice of recognizing these gifts and giving thanks for them is a new one for me. I've not always been open to receiving love. I think it's always a lot easier to give love than it is to receive it. But I'm learning. And as I learn to receive the love of others here and beyond, I become all the more aware of how this community, this fellowship, has impacted the wider world. As I enter into gratitude for the love felt within these walls, I somehow become more aware of the necessity of our love's presence beyond these walls. As a community of pilgrims and journey folk, we are called not only to provide refuge and support to one another, we are also called to make the world more friendly for other pilgrims, those we know and those we have not yet met. We are called to make the world more safe for the journey and more open for others to explore. I want to talk about one way in which this is happening here that I've observed in my time. I'm a little bit of a stats geek, but I'm not going to get totally into the stats because I know that not everyone is, especially on Sunday mornings. But we've talked, especially over the sermon series over the past month that Roger did, about the changing demographics in Appleton. And as a wide population, the percentage of African American and Hispanic people in this community over the past 10 years has doubled. If you look at the schools, it's actually the increase is more than that percentage-wise. It's actually tripled over the past 10 years. Now, there are a lot of ways to understand this, but the important point is that Appleton is changing. Appleton is becoming more diverse. And behind this growth and ahead of it have been the efforts of people in this congregation. The organization that I mentioned earlier, Toward Community, Unity, and Diversity, is a grassroots interfaith organization of volunteers that was begun by Roger and Scott Peoples and others in 1993 to, in their words, promote appreciation for the growing diversity in our community and to advocate justice for people of all cultures and ethnic backgrounds. Over the years, their active membership has risen from 3 to over 100. Attendance at their events, such as the annual Martin Luther King Interfaith Celebration, now reaches over 500. The organization also works closely with Appleton's diversity coordinator, which is a full-time position that has been part of the mayor's office since 1997, who is also a member here. And while I'm certainly not trying to claim credit for the actions of any of these individuals, it is nonetheless something, especially from my fresh eyes, to notice that there's a common connection to this fellowship. As a newcomer to the area, from my perspective, it is beyond coincidence that members of this fellowship, you, my kindred spiritual pilgrims, are also involved in journeys across lines of culture and race and ethnicity. And while there is no statistic, no census data to support such a claim, I have to think that the work of this fellowship and its people has a lot to do with the area's changing demographics and increasing hospitality to people of diverse backgrounds. After all, there is now a space in our public dialogue for matters of multiculturalism, race, and diversity. And the people of this fellowship are among those who created and held that space and still do. The history of this fellowship is rich with similar stories of passion and courage, compassion, and a wide and mutual embrace. I've spoken of multiculturalism and racial healing, but there are many more expressions of this congregation's collaborative work to transform ourselves, the Fox Valley, and the world. The impact of this congregation is also substantial with regard to issues of sexuality and gender. Our work mentoring other Unitarian Universalist congregations gives us a national reach. And our partner church work in Transylvania and the Philippines calls us beyond the walls even of nations. All of this is to say that we here at the Fellowship are varied and diverse in our passions. And we are working to make the world, and especially our community, more friendly and hospitable to all kinds of variety and diversity. From my fresh eyes upon you, it is clear to me that this fellowship's presence in this community is not only uplifting and enlivening, not only welcoming and fun, but also liberating and affirming and challenging and downright necessary. We are all pilgrims here, friends. We are all on a journey. We are travelers in a world that is not ours alone, a world too big to ever know fully. We rely on one another. As Zoli said on Christmas Eve, we belong to one another. May this community remain both a refuge and a catalyst. May we remember that the predictability of a well depends on motion, on action. A well requires deep waters flowing freely. A well relies on diggers thinking beyond themselves to their village and their children. Our well relies on remaining in touch with that existential thirst for meaning that is common to every person. Our well relies on serving strangers and fellow pilgrims who may be in need of a drink. In short, friends, our well relies on us.
After beating around the bush a little too much in my early days about the topic of the fellowship and money, I have decided that straight talk is a better way to go. So here's a little bit of straight talk about money. Giving money to the fellowship is one of the ways that we build wells that will sustain us and those who follow. We need money to pay the staff, pay the mortgage, pay for the heat. And for the past 3 years, our income here has been pretty much flat, and it's not surprising given the economy and a capital campaign. But I have to tell you, I'm really hoping that this annual stewardship campaign that we're about to begin will enable us, after 3 years of being flat, to go up a little bit. This would help us feel more confident about starting our building addition, since we will fund that project partly from money we borrow and we'll have to pay back through our operating budget. It'll help us land an outstanding second minister so we can continue having the excellence that we have so enjoyed and appreciated, provided by first Dottie and now Jason. It also might enable us to give modest increases in pay to our staff, which we haven't done for a while, and maybe even increase our staffing a bit. There have been a lot of people lately suggesting that it is time or past time to increase the hours of our music director. That would move from the realm of the impossible to the possible if we have more revenue. Our building addition, appreciating and retaining and maybe even adding to our excellent staff, these are important, and these are ways that the fellowship will help fulfill that sacred purpose first articulated almost 60 years ago. I'm excited that this year's stewardship campaign is inviting us to consider giving away a percentage of our income. My wife and I decided several years ago that we would like to give away 10% of our income. We decided that giving away 10% of our income to organizations and causes that are near and dear to our hearts would help us feel not like we're just spending money on ourselves, but also on building a better world. At the time, I have to say, we were very, very far from 10%. It felt like an impossibly high goal, but rather than throwing up our hands in defeat, we decided to get there one small step at a time. So we committed ourselves to increasing the percentage we gave away by going up maybe, you know, 0.5% or 1% a year until we got to 10%. And after several years of that slow incremental progress, We made it. And now with two kids in college, we have committed to maintaining our giving at that level. And because our congregations, and we belong to separate congregations, that they mean so much to us, we give about 4% of our income to each of our congregations, and then another 2% we give away to other organizations and causes. I'm not suggesting today that you all need to give away 10% of your income, but I am encouraging you to give some deep thought and discernment to how you spend your money. And if, after doing that, you decide you'd like to give away more, I encourage you to pick a goal and then start incrementally working toward it. And I also would invite you to reflect on how it might feel to give away more of your money. My hunch is it'll feel good. I know I've never actually regretted giving away money. So my motto is, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. So we have a treasure here at the Fellowship, I think, of incalculable worth. And what makes it so are the deep wells that we and many others have dug. If you need some inspiration to keep on digging, I want to share a little story of dedication to our faith that comes from our partner church in the Philippines. A couple from our partner church recently wrote a letter to one of our members here thanking him for helping to pay for the education of their child. So in this letter, they... ...is in the neighboring village from where they live. They get the church on foot. This is what they wrote. We start out at 6 o'clock in the morning, and we reach the church at 8:30, sometimes 9 o'clock. We have 30 minutes to rest before adult religious education starts at 10:30 and ends at 10:30. And then worship starts at 10:30 to 11:30. We bring food for lunch so that after the worship we have something to eat before going home under the heat of the sun. Sometimes we eat at our minister's house, we rest for a while, and then go home when the sun rays are not quite so hot. So walking 3 hours to church and 3 hours home, that's dedication. I don't think anyone does that here, but I could well imagine some people would. And I can, in my mind, picture that same kind of dedication from so many people. Fellow. To me, this is a picture of dedication that I see in different ways reflected here. As we look ahead, we cannot foresee the challenges that the fellowship will face or ways that will make a difference in the world. What I do know is that the deep wells will continue to nourish us and that together we will contribute to building a better world and that the fellowship will meet